Spirit of Nigeria Radio, bringing Nigerians in diaspora up to speed, the authentic source of Nigerian information, positive Nigerian energy all the way. Okay, right about now, it's time for Diaspora Discourse on Spirit of Nigeria Radio. Yes, Diaspora Discourse, bringing Nigerians in diaspora closer home. All right, so who are we bringing closer home today? Who will be talking to today? We will be talking to Dr. Akinyemi. And we will be talking about Nigeria Urban Planning Diaspora Perspective. Nigeria Urban Planning Diaspora Perspective. We'll be looking at the Nigeria environment. We'll be looking at different aspects of the Nigeria environment and things pertaining to the Nigeria environment. It's going to be quite broad because we're going to be talking about so many things. So many things that you probably didn't even know about your environment. And in comparison to the diaspora environment. Okay, so like I mentioned, we'll be talking to Dr. Akinyemi. Good day to you, sir.
Good day to you, my brothers and sisters back in motherland. I am blessed today to be speaking to all of you. It's a great day, at least here in Tallahassee. I hope it is as well. Absolutely. In Lagos. Yes,
absolutely. It's a beautiful day and a great one in Nigeria. All right, Dr. Akinyemi, I already mentioned to our listeners that we are talking to Dr. Akinyemi. And of course, I should welcome you to Spirit of Nigeria Radio. You're welcome to Spirit of Nigeria Radio, sir.
Congratulations on your launch. I hope to be a regular listener. And it's a good way to get out the message and the media and important work that we need to do in Nigeria. So again, I commend you for launching this radio program.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, sir.
Okay, so let me officially introduce myself. I'm Yonisola Adeosi, and I have my partner.
I am Mark DK Dinkba.
All right, sir. Okay.
Can I call you DK?
Yes, it's okay.
All right, sir. Okay, so I would be taking our listeners through who Dr. Akinyemi is. And Dr. Akinyemi was born in Lagos, Nigeria, after completing his Bachelor of Environmental Design from the University of Lagos in 1981. He worked for a year, then migrated to the United States. In 1985, he received his Bachelor of Architecture and Housing Development from the University of Minnesota in 1988. He received his Master of Architecture from Florida A&M University, where he developed a blueprint for sustainable community development. After completing his three-year internship with a nationally acclaimed architectural urban planning firm in Atlanta and passing his licensing exams, Akin started Aki and Associates Architects Incorporation in 1992. The firm specializes in educational, correctional and religious facilities planning and facilities programming. Its firm grew from a regional firm with offices in Atlanta, Georgia, Jacksonville, and Tallahassee, Florida, and he served as the principal architect until 2014. Akin also recently completed his doctorate in urban and regional planning. In 2008, Akin was elected as an at-large member of the Leon County Board of County Commissioners, Tallahassee, Florida, on a platform of environmental stewardship, economic and community development, accountable and accessible government. He was the first naturalized citizen to ever be elected to such position in the United States. Okay, at this point, I do not have a bell, but I get to give a round of applause. He served as a chairman of the board from November 2011 through November 2012. In 2016, Akin was elected as the first African-American Leon County property appraiser and one of two in Florida. As property appraiser, he oversees the state-mandated responsibilities of the office, including managing and certifying property values and exemptions for over 109,000 parcels, which total close to $29.8 billion in just value and $17.6 billion in taxable value annually. He brought to this position his broad experience as an architect, planner, building assessor, and former commissioner and chair of the Value Adjustment Board. It was also recently re-elected with no opposition to a second four-year term. Aki has been an active member of the Leon County community for more than 30 years and is a strong advocate for community involvement and service. He is currently serving or has served on various boards and committees such as Brion Family Services, National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, Rotary, Goodwill, United States Green Building Council, Leon County Schools Student Advisory Council, and District Advisory Council, to name a few. He has also received numerous awards such as induction into the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, Civil Rights Hall of Fame, C.K. Steele Honoree, Florida Association of Counties President's Advocacy Award, Small Business Person and Firm of the Year, to name a few. Aki is recently married and has 3 children and 4 grandchildren. Once again, I say welcome to Spirit of Nigeria Radio, and it is such a honor to have you here with us today.
Sister Toyinsola, thank you for that rousing intro. I was wondering who you were talking about, but I guess that would be me.
Okay, so well, I apologize, but to correct you, it is Yoinsola, not Toyinsola.
No, it was well done.
All right, thank you very much. Okay, so let's go to the business of the day. We're talking about Nigeria Urban Planning Diaspora Perspective.
Yes.
And, we would like to take a very critical look at the Nigeria environment in comparison to urban planning in the diaspora. And we want to look at different areas in terms of environmental design. Under environmental design, we would like to look at collapsed structures, flooding, and polluted environment. Also, we would take a look at green areas and importance to urban sustainability and exploitation of natural resources. Also, we'll be looking at new towns development and best approach in planning for new towns. So my very first question for you, sir, is how will you describe environmental design?
I would say it's been a struggle. And I say that kindly. As you noted, my career started at Unilag, you know, back in 1978. Even then, we as designers, we are at odds with ourselves in trying to define ourselves. That is sort of a discourse between architects, civil engineer, and environmental planner. My recent visit though, to Unilag, probably 3 times in the last 10 years, it's been very rewarding. And not only have they consolidated all of the different design disciplines, they've also incorporated building management and other aspects. So I'm glad to see that we are beginning to go on the right path.
Okay.
However, with regards to the what I call the outcomes in terms of measuring successes of effort that has been put in, I think the jury is still out on that one.
Okay, thank you very much, sir. All right, I want to ask very quickly, you know, we're talking urban planning, diaspora perspective, and, you know, you said there's been quite a trouble in, you know, in establishing different parts in line with environmental design. But first of all, let's look at urban planning. How would you describe urban planning from your own professional angle?
I'm going to give you 2 histories of different trajectory. First, the history of planning in Nigeria, and I'm going to contrast that with the history of planning in the United States.
Okay.
Nigerian planning, as most of the, what I call the former British colonies, actually started as a precondition to independence. About 5 years prior to each country independence, the British government put in place a process for developing national plan. And so the Nigerian first national plan was adopted in 1962. There's been about 6 or 7 iterations of that plan culminating in the Vision 2020. And I think there has been successes made in that regards. Contrasting that with planning in the US, which actually was in 2 phases, planning in Britain and in the U.S., the early past was about 1890, and then that moves on up until about after the Second World War, Then they entered the reconstruction phase in the 1945-1950.
Okay.
And there's common threshold between both planning. There's the aspect of financial allotment of money. There's the aspect of physical development. But in my opinion, urban planning in terms of design, okay, even in the U.S. context, seems to be a little missing. Effort is placed primarily on traffic engineering and infrastructure, but very little on beautification and design. There's a joke among the architects that traffic engineers ought to go to design schools.
Okay.
I want to shout out and commend our past governor, Fashola. I think when I came to Nigeria in 2010, I was interviewed, and that happened to be about the time it was launching a statewide beautification efforts.
Okay.
I'm sure most of them are hopefully being maintained. So I think there is room for improvement, and as we discuss this interview further, we can go into specific efforts and aspects and what can be done to improve planning in Nigeria.
Okay, all right. Thank you very much for that. You mentioned a couple of things. You mentioned that in 1962, urban planning in Nigeria began in 1962. And looking at it, you also mentioned that from 1962 to date, a lot has been done. And it has been achieved. And you also mentioned the Vision 2020. And, you know, in comparison to the diaspora, would you say that, let me just ask, in comparison to that with the diaspora, would you say that urban planning in Nigeria is not doing too bad? Because you also mentioned that in the diaspora, they focus a lot on, you know, architectural and so many other things, but they leave out beautification and design. So, if you're talking about beautification and design, are you saying that it is a completely different aspect of urban planning and urban development? And then, secondly, for Nigeria, you know, would you say that Nigeria isn't doing too bad in terms of urban planning generally?
Let me say this: I am most familiar with Lagos, so I will not speak generally for Nigeria overall, because most of I did study other cities as well in the last 5 years, but most of my focus has been on Lagos.
Okay.
So in terms of planning in Lagos, I think there's been significant improvements.
Okay.
What we have to tie this to eventually, and I'm sure Dotun, my brother, is very keen on this, is sustainability, ecotourism, drainage. Like I said, we will get all of that details later.
Okay.
But just quickly, for purposes of people who might want to Google and follow these things, people use different terminologies. Probably the single most used terminology is called physical planning. Mm. I mean, there are distinctions and differences. And then, of course, the next most used term is development planning.
Okay.
And lastly, urban planning. Because urban planning is really a subset of those first two. Mm. So if you were to Google and search the issue of planning, you're not very likely to hear urban planning. You are more likely to hear physical planning or development planning. They're all interrelated, they're all interconnected, but I'm just putting that in case people in academia or women want to follow up and trying to Google all this history, that kind of put things into perspective.
Okay, you mentioned that you are more familiar with Lagos, but I want to believe that
yes,
you must have gone to some other areas in Nigeria, maybe your village as well or something. Okay, so
yeah, I can give you history.
Okay, for now, let's save the history first. I want to know from your perspective, of course, looking at the Nigerian environmental design on a larger scale, in terms of spacing and how people live together or apart, do you think it is organized properly and healthy in terms of spacing and the whole general environmental design in Nigeria as a larger country?
Well, that's a very tough question, and the reason why that is tough is there's oftentimes differences between planning and implementation.
Okay.
What is planned on paper is one thing, what is implemented is another thing. And to make all of that worse, urban sprawling, you can call it slum, you can call it shantytown, whatever different term, different country used in Africa. I can give you probably one of the clearest example in terms of efforts is in Abuja. Okay. When Abuja was planned and will begin to be occupied, you know, from the late 70s to the 90s, within 10 years, there begin to be sprawl and slums. And the government made every effort, almost every year or two, to tear them down, to make the outcome to be similar to the intent. In terms of density and distribution, I can kind of give you a term that is used mostly in the U.S. Every city or every settlement have three, what I call, phases or three cores. Mm-hmm. At the center, you have your CBD, your central business district. Okay. Following that, you have your suburbs. And lastly, you have the rural areas. Mm-hmm. Now, what is not acknowledged in teaching planning or even in that three sequence is shanty towns of sprawl, because nobody really want to acknowledge them, so they never even discuss in their context, only in terms of what we need to do to make things better. In terms, because Lagos and really most African cities have actually grown before they were planned, it was sort of very difficult to maintain what I call adequate spacing and density. Yeah. Things kind of just happen. I mean, I don't know in the past 2-3 years, I've been back from the last 2 years. My most extensive study was done in 2015. We are doing comparative study. I would love to go into that. But maybe now there's effort. For instance, you know, we can talk about Eco-Atlantic. We can talk about other new developed new towns that spread out all of Africa. I have history on all of those as well. But the issue of density of spacing is also very debatable. Different school of thoughts. Some people may prefer a more dense arrangement. Other people may prefer a more sparse arrangement. So I don't think there's consensus, even among planning professionals, as to what is right and what is wrong. I hope that answered the question. If not, I'd be glad to do a follow-up.
Yeah. But a little bit on that. The issue of cities being peopled before they are developed becomes a given that in African cities, particularly here in Nigeria, many cities like that around the country were more people before they were planned. So having come this far now, what would you advise state governments, for instance, to do with such a situation in order to rearrange the city, so to say, so that it is planned even with the people inside?
I'm going to use two terms, and I'm sure you're both familiar with both of these terms. One is resettlement, and one is gentrification. Okay. I mean, both of those terms have both positive and negative connotations. Even in the U.S., there's often suspicion when those terms were mentioned because of past failures. Yes, if you want to avert further natural disasters, you know, like mudslides and things like that, you can argue for resettlement. You can argue for reduced density and sort of move people out into more livable conditions. Those terms are very controversial because oftentimes that might be the disguise or the promise that was made, but invariably when the outcome is seen, what happens is that the poor people get displaced. Maybe only 10 of them may get resettled somewhere. The rest are kind of like, you know, we don't care about you. Mm. And that particular premium locations are replaced with more expensive settlements. Mm. Eco-Atlantic is a perfect example of that. In the U.S., gentrification is a very, very controversial issue. Some planners favors it, and they talk about it is a good investment because you do what is called highest and best use, and you improve the environment. But most minority communities are very suspicious of it because even though they were promised that they will be able to return, and yes, in a free system, anybody can return, But the prices of the new units are often so expensive that they can't afford to return. It's not a matter of they are being prevented from return. The economics of the development just simply does not permit them to return. So going back to Lagos specifically in terms of resettlement, I mean, let's take two areas, for instance, Surulere and Mushin. I mean, when you look at the densities in those areas and to begin to say, okay, how can we resettle? One thing that was done in a lot of other African countries and probably in America as well, and we haven't seen a lot in Lagos, is high-rise construction. If you look at China, the way China and Japan house their people, again, I'm not saying this is a better way, it's doing high-rise, because if you want to really have more open space, if you want to have things to look less congested, but yet house this number of people within the same footprint, the alternative is not to displace them and move them 5-10 miles out when they can't really have transportation to come back in, is to revert into high-rise development. That's pros and cons to that concept, but I honestly, in my recent studies, I don't see where that's being discussed, again, other than the context of the Co-Atlantic, but in terms of the poor people, a good example is the Akinwande housing that was done in the early 80s. They're still there, even in the mid-70s for Festac. Not just in Festac area, but even in Surulere, right across from the stadium, you still see them, the houses. They are all four stories. I mean, it's medium rise, it's not high rise, but that's sort of a precursor to a higher density development where people can still, you don't have to be one or two story, which is common in most cases. You can move up to 8 to 10 stories. It's still not a difficult technology to do, but by doing that, people can still be close to their work. They can be close to their families, and they don't have to be displaced.
All right. Thank you very much for that. But you mentioned something about the high-rise buildings. You said that you're not saying that it's a better option, but you also said that there is more to say, you know, on high-rise buildings. But looking at it, you also mentioned that it's a bit better because, you know, people get to be close to their work and, you know, other things that they have to do. But Why would you say that it's not exactly a better option?
What would be the better option as well?
Well, let me give you some example where I say it's not, and you can Google this history too. Public housing in the U.S. has been a disaster. Mm-hmm. I mean, between the 50s and the 80s, there was a lot of them built, and they were all high-rise, you know, concrete jungles. But because of the way they were done, again, they were put away from work centers. They were poorly lit. There was no what we call environmental design for social, you know, protection. That's the way you design things that people doesn't, there's no death corners. People can't get kidnapped or raped and things like that. There was a place called Pro Eagle, IGO, Pro Eagle in St. Louis. It's been demolished now. This place was built, and for 30 years, it was like a nightmare. So high-rise can be really done poorly. But at the same time, it can be done very successfully. I just returned from Toronto recently, and it's just amazing the extent and the degree of high-rise development that you are able to find a lot of people living right in downtown. You don't see that in a lot of U.S. cities unless you are very, very rich. So what I'm saying is that I'm not for or against it, but at least it should be up for debate. It should be up for discussions, and it should be something that should be explored, and people can bring out their experiences and issues and find out a way to effectively do it. I mean, there is some dichotomy in planning. For instance, you know, big versus small. Central versus local control. People talk about those terms as if they are all zero-sum game, as if it's one or the other. Those kind of concepts are not mutually exclusive. There are ways, when done properly, to be able to have a marriage of those two concepts, to be able to have density and yet humanity, density and beauty, density and closeness. You could even have rooftop balconies. You could have rooftop garden. You could do different things to make these places livable. You know, it's how you design it. It's how much effort you put to make it work.
Okay, talking about the quality of these structures, talking about high-rise being done poorly, and you know all other things that you mentioned in that line. Now it brings me to collapsed structures, and well, in Nigeria, even as at last week, it was still in the news. As a matter of fact, this week, it was still in the news that a building in Lagos collapsed. And it's not the first time. We hear it year in, year out. You know, you hear a lot about collapsed buildings. And, you know, I want to ask, who is responsible for a building collapse? Is it the architect or the engineers? And what are the major causes of collapsed structures in Nigeria?
There are too many players involved. In my opinion, okay, you have an owner, they hire an architect, hire a team of engineers to help him do the best possible. The local government has a building department, they do plan review, they do inspections. And then, of course, you have the contractor who is charged to implement this. The owner rely on the architectural team, the architect and structural engineer and the other engineers to oversee the contractor to make sure that they do the job properly. Usually, the local government control primarily is on compliance with code, not necessarily the durability. I mean, structure is part of the code too, don't get me wrong, but it's not really the local government fault, responsibility. It's mostly the team, and I have to be very careful here because we get a bad rap. When something goes wrong, everybody blame the architect. That is sort of the common scapegoat. From my experience, and there is some validity to that because the architect is sort of the stopgap in terms of the point of control from all aspects. But it's about a team effort. Now, the other thing in Nigeria that entered the equation is also corruption. When there's so much corruption, most of the money, you know, says chop chop, most of the money done the chop and they're gone, the contractor has to start cutting corners. As an architect, you can't be there 24/7. You cannot be there every day, every time. Some things are done, and by the time you get there, you're not going to say, "Tear this wall down. I want to see how many rebuys in this wall." So there are so many factors that goes into that. But part of the other factor, and this is something that's not often talked about, is geotechnical engineering. There are technologies that will help you do sonic testing. There are technology that will help you deal with, because they say a house is as strong as its foundation. Okay. You can have the most beautiful, well-built house, but the foundation is shaky. It's going to collapse sooner or later. So making sure that there's proper soil testing, there's proper compaction, and there's proper bearing for the load that soil intends to bear are all important aspects. So, and I feel for these people, these are all, I mean, almost every party of Lagos I have families in. Idumota area, Olubole, all these people that have collapsed, I think it was maybe 2 years ago, I've not known about the one this week. One of my nephew, you know, is a building inspector, and he talked about it all the time on Facebook. In fact, he was interviewed, I believe, when I was home, during the last collapse, and he was talking to this on TV as to some of these reasons, you know, hopefully they're hearing the warning and they're taking better controls.
Okay. All right. Talking about, you know, building collapse, you mentioned something on geotechnic engineers. And I want you to shed a little bit more light on that. Are you saying that these geotechnic engineers, is it that they use technology to inspect the quality of the building or the construction? Or what exactly, what role do they play in this line?
Let me also clarify, there are two aspects of this, because the heart is not static. I mean, there is movements. I mean, there is the vibrations, the impact of other development that happen later that may affect the quality and stability of a structure. So let me not blame it at all on what I call the first team. But the first team work is important, and I'm sure I only passed in Nigeria for 1 year, as you mentioned, and I worked for a very good architectural firm. So I do know a little bit about the workings of the Nigerian system as well. This was in 81 through 82, after I finished Unilag. And there are steps to be taken. One of the first things you do as you're designing, before you finance your design, you actually give a geotechnical engineer sort of a footprint of where you intend to put the building. And they do borings. And that borings will bring back the test result as to the bearing capacity of that soil. That decision will help you to finalize your type of design. You may have to go from, say, bearing construction to a pile construction. You may have to do some monolithic or thickened slab. You may have to take measures. Or even at worst, you may have to actually change your site and say, this site is not suitable, need to go to a different site. So those first step measures are very, very important in taking into consideration. Once you go past that phase, even as you begin the construction itself, they take core boring of this for like 30 days. They monitor you for possible crack. All those things, you have to do that. Then invariably, and this is something that most people don't do, what we call the POE, post-occupancy evaluation. Over the years, people should pay attention to cracks in the wall. When you see crack in wall, it's a sign of distress from the foundation. And people need to begin to pay attention to that and take remedial measure and not just simply wait for something to collapse. So I'm not aware of any code requirement, not even in the U.S., where you are required to do this. Some big clients like universities put into the contracts, and they make us go back year after year to do this, and they're willing to pay for it, but it's not a code requirement. So maybe Nigeria need to consider some sort of a POE requirement when it comes to the soundness and continuous soundness of building foundations.
Okay, so you've mentioned something about how local government authorities as well play roles in constructions. In Lagos, for instance, including a city like Port Harcourt, we've witnessed situations where building owners, especially residential building owners, landlords, who probably have two-story buildings or three stories or one, after some years, they just wake up one morning and decide to add an extra layer up there just to make more money. Yep. And this can be done so swiftly that even the local government authorities might not even notice. And this also increases the burden of a building and might cause a collapse in a few years' time. As an expert in this area, what would you advise the authorities to do in such situations to forestall it?
That is a tough one. And I can imagine that most departments are probably already understaffed and overstressed with what they have to do, leading them to start having to police people. Here's what I can say to my professionals in Nigeria. Additions, future additions are not uncommon. People do it in the U.S. Okay. There are two ways to do future additions. If you think that you might want to add more later, you can over-design your foundations and your columns and beam capacity. Your beam for the first three floors may be sized 25% more than it should be to be able to carry one or two more floors in the future. But you can plan for this in advance. You can document that. So when you do that in adaptation in the future, it will not collapse. That's one way to do it. Secondly, if you didn't plan for it and you want to do it anyway, again, that is done here quite frequently, then you have to examine the capacity of the existing structure to bear it. Oftentimes, it's possible that it can bear it. If it cannot bear it, you can actually install new columns. You can step out, say, 2 or 3 feet from the existing foundation. You almost create a new foundation, a new column that carries the upper floors. So, I mean, there are definitely creative ways to do this, but when you just simply do it without professional expertise, without advice, that's when you endanger people's lives and the people around. The tenants or the neighbors should be the eye keeper, should be the one that they shouldn't feel like they're rather than people. They should be able to feel empowered to call the authority and say, look, we saw this thing going on. Are you aware of it? They do permit it. Not to be, you know, rats, but to be prudent citizens, watch out for their own life and safety.
Well, the landlord might just increase the rent if they catch you going to tell the authorities.
A victory,
exactly. All right, thank you very much for that. Okay, so let's talk about it. You know, you mentioned something about these houses that, you know, from time to time, there was one key point that you mentioned that I'm holding on to and I expect, you know, listeners to hold on to it as well, talking about when you begin to see cracks, you know, on probably the walls of a house, you should start, you know, you should take notice and to do something about it to fix up, you know, before, because it can lead to building collapse. But looking at it generally, even without cracks and all of those other things, do these buildings have a certain lifespan?
Yes. I'll give you two examples in the U.S. Most residential constructions are built to what are called a 30-year lifespan. Most commercial are built to a 50-year lifespan. Now, having said that, it does not mean that it's going to collapse exactly 30 years. I mean, you can see it lasts 60 years. But it means that when the design has been done, it's been done with those longevity in mind, you know. And again, that is not something that is discussed widely, even here in the U.S., when I do a lot of work for universities, we do a lot of renovations. And one of the things we do is when we look at a building, we look at when it was built, what was the code like during that time, what was its lifetime, and then we advise the owner if it's worthwhile to renovate that building or just simply tear it down and start all over again. Those are the norm. In terms of how long you should expect the building to last, even though, like I said, it could last twice as long. Now, there could be argument made that maybe that needs to be increased to maybe 40 for residential and 60 for commercial.
Okay.
I mean, those are all things that people should look at regularly.
Okay, all right. Thank you. So, looking at this, you know, you mentioned that some have 30 years and some have 50 years. And if we're looking at 30 years from now, I mean, 30 years from now, I can, and everybody can imagine the development and, you know, of course, the development that would have taken place in terms of even building structures, in terms of designs, and in terms of all other things in the line of development. Would you say that, you know, with developmental advancement and with quality of products that are used to build these houses, would you say it also has an impact on building collapse?
Absolutely. I mean, there needs to be constant advancement in building construction technologies. And I give an example. This was a long time ago. I was home, maybe even 15, 20 years. And one of my nephews took me to a building fair at Afara Balewa. Of course, the two most common thing at that point was metal roof and solar paneling.
Okay.
But there's also talking about electric generation, electric power, a lot of different building. We cannot be static. We cannot just keep doing the same thing over and over, expecting a different result. There need to be investment in building technologies,
okay.
Building technology research. I went to a department, I forget the name of it, in Abuja, where they actually give grants for people to come up with very innovative material, whether taking an existing material like adobe and enhancing it to have more strength, or simply doing, you know, post-tension concrete or whatever different technologies is out there that is the latest. So yes, you are right. Advancement in building construction technology is also a key part to building safety and building longevity.
All right. Thank you, sir. Okay, so you know, you've talked about flooding, and you know, well, we understand that Nigeria still has a long way to go in terms of building drainage system, and well, definitely we hope that we get there. Anyway, let's keep it going. Looking at constructing buildings at riverside, we know that such houses will be prone to flood. But notwithstanding, is there any plan or process that can be put in place in the process of building that can prevent, you know, prevent any damage to these buildings?
You mean like in riverine areas?
Riverine areas, absolutely.
Okay, great. I'm going to give you Jeremiah's name. He's one of my prodigy, and you can find him very, very easily.
Okay.
We are namesake. His name is Akin Afolayan.
Akin Afolayan.
Yes, Afolayan. His father is a renowned medical doctor in Oshobo. He's retired. He was the former minister of health, and now he runs like what they call Doctors Without Borders version of Nigeria,
okay,
where they go around to different areas to help people. And Akin's thesis was done on what they call flotation design.
Okay.
He designed like a community that completely floated. And he was able to get his father a template. They actually built a mobile medical center. It's like a boat.
Okay.
That's like a house.
Okay.
And they can float around to do stuff. I think you'll be able to find it. If you don't, again, I can give. It's on Facebook too. You can also look for him.
Okay.
He's in Texas now, but it's probably the person I can. It's the expert in that area.
Mm-hmm.
We have to be able to utilize our natural resources. And by the way, this is going to swing into ecotourism, which I hope at some point we can get to talk about as well.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of countries in the Caribbean, do so well by building resorts. And they're not very expensive. They have thatch roof, with palm trees. They have very low key type construction.
Okay.
They have a slope walkway system. So true, some of this may not withstand a huge hurricane or stuff like that. Fortunately, we don't have a lot of that in Nigeria. Most of them come to the US, believe it or not, in terms of the way the globe rotates. But there are designs, and I'm not an expert in that area by any means. Again, whether you deal with a concrete system or a wood system, or a power system, there are designs that you can do that people can live effectively, all these fishery communities.
Okay.
Of course, you have to regulate it. You have to be able to have standards.
Hmm.
So that, give an example. In the U.S., you design to work on wind loads, 60 miles an hour, 70, 80, 90, and so on and so forth.
Okay.
But really, something like that, a 30 miles an hour wind can blow them away. So you have to have standards that you have to design to where they can be sustainable and durable. But definitely, I would not give up on developing riverland areas. I think they are very aesthetically pleasing.
Okay.
There could be a huge tourist boom, and definitely I will support that.
Okay, Dr. Kemi, let's talk about pollution. Of course, this is a
whole yes.
big, big talk on its own, but just a little thing
for uh-huh.
you.
Yes.
Land, air, sea, everywhere.
Water.
We can't talk about plastic and all forms of material
uh-huh.
being thrown into water bodies.
Uh-huh.
I want to talk about air pollution. In the Niger Delta, for instance, the atmosphere is a mess. We also talk about
yes.
Open defecations here and there.
Waste
yes. materials not properly kept
Trust.
Around
mm.
in Nigeria. How would you look at that? And then
yes.
let's also include noise. Noise pollution is also there.
We can't even start
yes.
with the noise pollution.
Yes.
Talking about noise pollution in Nigeria, we're going to talk about the barber's shop that they just decided to put mount four speakers. And I'm wondering why.
Yes.
What is
yes.
going on? And then parties. And then you see Owambe, we want to just shut down a whole street.
On that,
yeah.
so much
is it the same thing where you are, for instance?
Now let's talk about religious.
No. Fortunately, not. Let me say this. I'm going to limit to air pollution right now because noise pollution is a whole different level. I know about decibel control and there are ordinances you can put in place for that.
Okay.
But talking about air pollution, just talking about green gas in general, let's kind of leave it in that level. Now, there's a misconception that cars are the biggest polluters
mm-hmm.
or consumer of energy.
Okay.
But you're not going to believe it. Buildings. And number one, it may be different, but in the U.S., buildings account for 38% of pollution. And I say that in terms of energy, anytime you use energy control for your AC, it emits, what I call particles and other elements that pollutants. Anytime you take out your trash can, like you mentioned, go to the landfill that's not properly disposed. So in terms of designing smart buildings, designing smart buildings that has less effect on the environment is probably one area that we need to focus on first and foremost. And yes, number two, cars. Designing smart cars, you know, battery-backed cars, you know, hybrids, all those different levels, or even to just simply have even a gasoline car that have a higher, or I mean, less emission rate or higher efficiency. You know, now the other aspect, which is probably the easiest to control, is what I call human habits.
Okay.
I mean, it really pained me when I go to the beach in Nigeria or even when in Accra, the amount of litter. Oh my goodness. And if you just simply put a bin like every 300 foot or so, and if you have beach patrol, just like we have people that patrol, people say, you can't cross, I'm going to whip you if you cross this road. If we make a priority, it's because it's not a priority of our leadership. Make it a priority to disidentify littering. Because littering, it has so many effects. First of all, those things biodegrade. They leave efficacies, I mean, different odors and smell that pollute the air. Not only some of them are not biodegradable, and so they don't dissolve. They don't become dirt. So, for me, I mentioned three things: you know, building design, cars, but the third and the biggest is just human habits. I'm sure there are five or six more. But if we focus on these three, in particular, the very last one, I think definitely we can improve our air quality. Mm-hmm. And air quality also tied into tourism. Mm-hmm. For people to come to your country to visit you and enjoy your natural beauties, you have to have good air qualities. You have to have pleasant environment. People are not going to see people defecating openly, you know, or peeing, you know, in every corner. I mean, those things are very, very detrimental on so many different levels.
Absolutely. All right.
Sorry, you've mentioned just a little thing about that open defecation, for instance. I believe that the lack of efficient planning in terms of building constructions or having enough public toilets is part of the problem. Okay, so how would you look at that? What would you advise? First of all, do you think Nigeria and Africa particularly, is having a five-year plan between 2020 and 2025 to stop open defecation? With the level of urbanization, do you see them us achieving that within the next 5 years?
Nigeria to be specific, sir.
Absolutely. I mean, that can be done. And let me also interject to actually my area of expertise in planning, which is self-help and citizen participation. We can only wait on our government for so long. Okay. We can only plan on our government to do things for us for so long. Yes, in terms of long-range planning, definitely having, remember back in the days of public schools, you have a little like a little water tap around the roundabout. People can go to and assemble and gather and do things like that. All those aspects, because that where people gather, they're likely to have, you know, disposable. So if you create every three or four blocks, instead of a town center, maybe a little gazebo, a little roundabout, things that people want to do, like a water tap, water fountain, you know, benches and seats, and dispose on a restroom. Those things create what I call focal point for the neighborhood, places to assemble, to enjoy, to socialize. At the same time, a place to dispose of things. Now, should the government put into their plan? Absolutely. But what if you don't? What if you have a neighbor association and you guys get together on your own and agree to do some of these things and develop a way to raise money to do it? Of course, you have to get the local government permission. Because, hey, look, you should be doing it, but you're not going to do it, but we're going to do it for ourselves. At least give us a piece of land. Give us permission to do these things. And maybe give us 20% of the funding, and we'll raise the rest of it. You know, that is sort of what my thesis premise is on when I did my master's. was sort of the same continuation when I did my dissertation recently, was exploring these methods and trying to show that if you give proper incentives, if you yield control to people, because people will not do these things if you don't give them authority and control. But if the government yield control to the citizens and empower them to some of these things for themselves, you can see if you were to form a group, say, right away in the next 3 months, and you come up with a plan, say, within a year, that everybody can build, get a consensus and begin to raise money. And then in the next 2 years, begin to actually hopefully physically implement it. Yes, in 5 years, you could see a marked improvement. You know, and Dr. knows about my dissertation. It was part of my study. He can tell you more about it. And I'd be glad to send you excerpts into that regard. But for me, self-empowerment, self-help, and citizen participation are to me the way, or should be, let me put it that way, because I know historically they haven't been. They were popular in the 80s, and they kind of disappeared. But if done properly, they could be the long-term solution to all these things that we've discussed today, whether it's planning, whether it's implementation, whether it's pollution. You know, empowering citizens could really be a key part of this.
Okay, all right. Talking about citizen empowerment, talking about sensitization of the citizens, yeah. You know, I know that even when it comes to properly trashing dirt in Nigeria, it's a major challenge. And I know how much the government has been trying hard,
yes,
to sensitize the people on how to properly dispose waste. But comparing Nigeria to the diaspora, you know, I know that the people have a better understanding on how to dispose waste, and Nigeria is still a major challenge. Mm-hmm. Of course, you mentioned even disposing dirt into the seas and all of that. But what would you say when it comes to proper sensitization? What other method can be used, and how in the diaspora is there? I know definitely it wasn't magic. These things are not achieved with magic. You can't just call somebody and say, okay, poof, and then they just begin to cooperate. But how can the government go about this? How can it be done to properly sensitize the people on how to, you know, trash waste products appropriately?
There are so many different ways. And thank you for asking this very important question. And again, I hate saying Dotun, because Dotun was one of the most vocal people that I interviewed, and he gave a lot of great ideas.
Okay.
Public information, and of course the two most common media is radio and TV, for instance. But the two mentioned some other unorthodox system, like soccer fields, where people assemble and gather, where people are more likely to be reached at their level, not just at some other different level. Being able to develop a public information system, whether it's going to be videos, whether it's going to be even, you know, charts, you know, tweet and things like that, to develop a very powerful system that while people are assembling, they're having a good time, you could say, hey, man, let me show you something on my phone. Give your phone to somebody and talk about it. The key is to develop, of course, policy guidelines, first and foremost, but then develop a public information system, a PR way, to get people to really see the benefits of this thing. And those two have to precede any kind of organization, because otherwise it's going to flop. If you have a very good plan, if you market it very, very well, then you can begin to form groups of people who then see the value in what you're trying to do, and hopefully they will take it seriously and they will do it. Now, in my opinion, the end part of it is pride. If you own something, if you help to make something happen, you are more likely to maintain it, to protect it, and to preserve it, to the point where when people are defecating the work that you did, you can probably fight them for it and say, no, you're not going to do that here. We worked very, very hard to make this happen. So I think that empowerment and inclusion are going to be the key to be be able to then maintain, because you can do all these things and they could be destroyed later, but to be able to maintain them is empowering people would be a really good way to do that.
All right. Thank you very much for that. I quite agree with empowering people. Thank you for that clarity. Okay, let's move on to another one that is of major importance. And I find this very sensitive. Talking about land pollution, and I want to take it from a different angle. Permit me to share this story. For land pollution, there was an article that was published in the newspaper this week, Killing Them Softly, a Lagos community where residents drink, bath with petrol water. To summarize this, Ejibo community has been experiencing water and land pollution because the community is home to one of the busiest satellite depots of the Nigerian National Petroleum Corporation. It is under the System 2B pipeline network, which accounts for 60% of fuel supply and distribution in the country. But leaky petroleum pipes are contaminating wells and boreholes. Now, my first question is, should petrol pipelines even be installed in residential areas?
Well, one thing about any kind of a distribution system, if you produce something somewhere, whether it's petroleum, whether it's natural gas, whether it's electricity, you have to distribute it. You have to get it to the source of use. So the answer is yes. The question should be not that should they be installed. The question is how should they be installed? What kind of a separation? What distances from homes? What distances from other amenities? Give an example. Almost every home in the U.S. have a sewer line and a water line. And there's a regulation that they must be kept at least 10 foot apart. So having regulations and guidelines to where and how this should be installed, also the quality of the material. Some material require copper, some require cast iron, some PVC may be enough. So there has to be all these good specifications as well as, of course, oversight in seeing that these are done properly. And when something fails, people have to be held accountable. The people that did it and cut corners, there ought to be penalties, whether criminal or civil fine for that. That would be the incentive for them to do it right in the first place.
Okay. All right. Thank you, sir. But looking at it, you know, the people have complained that since 2013 that they've been experiencing this challenge of their water being contaminated with petrol, and you know, nothing is being done about it, and NNPC isn't taking responsibility of this. But NNPC blamed the issue on vandals, you know, people who get to vandalize the pipelines. But notwithstanding.
Yep.
How do you think this can be fixed? What can be done about it? You know, we can't, looking at it, asking the people to leave or to leave the community, it looks, it sounds almost impossible. And at the same time, pipelines are not being fixed. What can be done about it in this kind of situation?
That is a very difficult question for me to answer. And I've heard about people who are tapping into petroleum and trying to siphon petrol. I'm going to talk about long time and short time. The long time solution to most problems, just like the civil unrest in the U.S. right now, is provided for people. If people have jobs, they have means to take care of themselves, they will not be resorting to this kind of vandalism. So for me, in the long run, we got to look for ways to provide for the impoverished in any community. That's for the long run. As far as the short run, obviously life is endangered and these things have to be done. Now, you have to look at two approaches. Short run, which may not last very long, is patch job. If you find a leak, maybe you patch it. You patch it. But that may not be sustainable. And you ask yourself, how many patches am I going to do? If I patch every 6 months and I'm spending, you know, $500,000 5-6 times, if I just invest $10 million one time and do it right and redo everything completely, but for me, not being on the ground, not seeing the extents, it would be pretentious for me to recommend a solution. You have to really put a good team out there to go evaluate the situation, make recommendations to the best way to remedy these situations.
All right. Thank you very much, sir.
Okay. Our country is a country full of natural resources, from the north down south, so many resources here and there. Mm-hmm. And these things need to be tapped, or they are being tapped, or they have to be tapped. For economic and other reasons. Now, in terms of planning, just like she mentioned the issue of keeping or boring a pipeline in a residential area. Now, you mentioned the issue of distribution. This thing has to be tapped and distributed, and they have to pass through the land, and people are living on these lands. How is the best way so that... as regards natural resources tapping and people's settlement, the safety and, of course, insecurities or dangers that are involved. I mean, let's create a balance here. How do we ensure that resources are normally tapped and distributed without them causing issues for people? And then vis-a-vis creating green areas in Nigeria. How can all of this be put in place so that no one is left out and everyone is secure and safe?
Thank you. Another very difficult question to deal with. Let me approach it this way. One thing I've learned in life, even here in Florida as we speak, just because something is there, it does not have to be tapped. Okay. You have to look at cost benefits. Okay. You know, yes, you can make a few million dollars, but if you endanger people's life, is it worth it? I mean, Florida depends on tourism. It is the second, I think actually the first, tourism second largest income producing for the state of Florida. So if you try to tap to the gas or petroleum potential on the ocean, how does that destroy your tourism industry? What is the cost benefit? So first and foremost, we need to do a cost benefit studies and human impact study to see if these things are even worth tapping, even though they're there. The second thing is that once you decide that yes, it is worth it and you're going to do it, you have to do a very detailed, what I call recovery and mitigation plan. How do you recover this thing? And how do you mitigate any potential side effects? Again, these are beyond my pay grade. They are beyond my area of expertise. But as an environmentalist, I can definitely look at a plan and put my two cents worth and see if it makes sense or not. Unfortunately, those things don't happen. Even in the U.S., there's what I call lobbyists. I'm sure there are lobbyists in Nigeria. Lobbyists pay politicians a lot of money, and they have their ears. And oftentimes, politicians will listen more to lobbyists than listen to the scientists or the experts. So it's a very tough battle trying to get them to do the right thing, to make decisions in the best interest of the people versus the special interest, who are the multinational company that's going to be extracting these natural resources. So it's a tough one. Everywhere. And I just hope that Nigeria have the courage to do the right thing and learn from the failures of other countries, including the U.S. in this regard.
I think you need to send the Nigerian government an SMS on this.
There are
things they don't need to tap for the sake of the people.
Absolutely true. Okay, permit me, I know that you already mentioned that it's not your area of expertise, but I could still tap a little bit from, you know, your knowledge. Let's look at water pollution.
Yeah.
You know, there's an analysis that says that 19% of Nigerians' population has access to safe drinking water. Although 67% of people have basic water supply, access is uneven. Nigeria suffers from economic water scarcity, the inability to properly manage, use, and protect water resources for socio-economic development and environmental sustainability. What is your take on water management in Nigeria?
This is actually very interesting, and I don't want to digress too much. When I was doing my dissertation, I'm just going to quickly state the title of it to give you a sense. The title was Understanding the Factors That Increased Citizen Participation in Developments. And I went through probably about 15 different factors, adding up to about 7 eventually for me to study. I took out water out of the criteria, believing that we already have adequate water supply, and water as a provision to be included within the project parameter was not going to be a factor. And then every time I go home, my family, we put 4 or 6 huge, gallons, kegs in the car. And on the way back, they go and pay and get this water. It's like, don't you have water taps at home? So, well, it hardly works. Half of the time, there's no flow. And then when I did my qualitative follow-up, because I did not include water in my quantitative analysis, which talked to citizens about to rate different factors, I found out, believe it or not, in the qualitative aspect of it, that water provision was an important issue to them. That even electricity, that is even just beyond them in terms of technicality of provision, but by merely buying transformers and fixing broken transformer, it's also an important factor. So I say this to say, even we as experts, we don't always know it all. So yes, contrary to my belief for so long, water inadequacy is an issue. And I'm so glad too, when you said 90%, I was worrying because I also did a study some years back where I compare, I think 5 or 6 different African countries, including Nigeria, Accra, I think Kenya, South Africa, and so on. And in that study, yes, I listed different things, literacy rates, access to water, access to all those different factors. And I remember clearly 60% was the number that I see. So if I understand you correctly, 68% have access to water, but only 19% have access to what I call good quality water, not just anything. So that is a very disturbing number that I didn't really think about. And now that you mentioned it came back full circle to me. Again, all these things have been done together. This is the essence, again, of my pilot project that I did, was that you take a street, say 10 blocks of streets, and you develop a prototype. And in developing these things, you improve the drainage system, you lay pipes, for water systems. You even lay pipes for future underground electricity. Right now, everything is all overhead. So I know this is sort of a little bit off subject, but there are ways to really do to improve the access to what I call quality potable water.
Okay, thank you very much. You mentioned something about future. You mentioned something about future electricity. I'm so sorry, I didn't get that part clearly, but it got me talking about
Yes.
Okay.
I can explain. Even here in the U.S., most power supply is overhead. You have a pole, and you have all these wires that look very, very ugly. And lately, we've had more hurricanes than in previous years. And every time you have a lot of heavy winds, these are affected. When I look at my pilot project in Lagos, which is Akiton Street from Ojulegba to Clegg, that stretch, and you look at the dilapidation, just the ugliness of the power lines, but they also take away width that you could use, say, for sidewalk or for gutter or even for the road itself. So even though this is a far-fetched and it may not happen for even 10, 20 years, while you are digging these deep gutters and widening the road, you can lay pipes because the way electricity works, even then you can lay pipe and come back 5 years later and run lines through it. What you do is you put a rope in it, and the rope at one end is come up and it's tied. So when you're ready to actually lay the underground pipe, you just tie the cable on one end, and you pull the rope to pull them through. So you can begin to plan ahead to bury all these power lines. It's not easy, but again, it's about if you plan ahead, you can do them.
I think it works. I think, of course, it's not easy. When it comes to development, nothing is easy, but I think it's a gradual process and we should be able to achieve it. Thank you very much. I'm looking at my time and I'm like, wow, we've gone like 1 hour, 30 minutes thereabout.
Yeah,
but let's look at some other very key areas. Pardon me. And this one is coming from the green areas. Looking at green areas in Nigeria, how important is it? How important is natural resources and how important is natural resources and environment to an environment, to a community, and how can it be maintained in a country like Nigeria? And you know, you mentioned something initially talking about how planting helps to prevent flood, and I was waiting on this particular point before we, you know, before we go deep into it. So please, let's talk about it in general. How is our natural resources in a country like Nigeria, how important is it?
Okay, I'm going to answer this by going back to high school biology.
Okay.
Talk about plants and animals. Mm-hmm. And we learn basic things that animals or human beings or any kind of in an animal group, we consume oxygen and we split out carbon dioxide.
Okay.
Plant, on the other side, absorbs carbon dioxide because there are nutrients in it. Carbon is sort of a nutrient, and then they spill out oxygen. So it is without saying that the more plants you have around you, the cleaner is your air, the higher is the oxygen content of your hair, which makes you more healthy, your skin tones is better. Now, we are fortunate, we are in a tropical rainforest as a region. Unfortunately, when you over-urbanize, you turn a rainforest into a concrete jungle because you just tear down, and you just build concrete. So we need to go back into beautification. We need to go back, and this has to start with our building codes. In the U.S., that's what is called a land-to-building ratio.
Okay.
That's what is called requirement for a green area. If you have a plot of land, typically we build almost to the perimeter, other than having to provide a place for car. Even for that, they're all paved. There ought to be a requirement. Okay, you cannot build more than 40% of your lot as far as the building footprint.
Okay.
Remaining 60%, maybe 30% can be paid for car, 30% have to be left as a green area. If you begin to have these requirements, I think we can reforestate Lagos. Because in my opinion, Lagos has been deforested for way too long. And the more you do this, the more you can improve your air quality, the more you can actually beautify the environment, make it look more attractive, make it look more desirable for people. And then that kind of also go back into ecotourism, into making people other country wanting to come and visit our country. So the benefits are enormous. But we have to start with the local ordinances, making requirements, and then people on their own having the willingness to do all this planting themselves.
Thank you, sir. But talking about, you know, you said something that really got my attention. You talked about over-urbanize. And, you know, for a state like Lagos, and of course we have other states, but, you know, taking Lagos as a case study, Lagos is literally overpopulated. And in this, because of the overpopulation, you know, we need to build more. We need to, should I say, stretch it out for, you know, to be able to accommodate the population of people who keep coming in day in, day out. But in this situation, you know, how is it possible to develop, to build, expand without having to tear down this the natural resources, the green plants?
Again, it depends on what I call priorities, and should we put more efforts in developing new towns or at least new neighborhoods as models, or should we focus more on rebuilding existing? Again, I'm not on the ground and I'm not in any kind of a physical capacity to do the comparison of what this will look like. But for me, I think a combination is possible.
Okay.
And it again goes down into policy. First, you have academic studies that points to issues and explore solutions. These academic studies then become adopted as policy by governments. And then you go into implementation, where you find a pilot project. That pilot project could be an existing stretch of street, or it could be a 20-acre land that can be developed from scratch to show what this can be done. Depending on the funding source, depending on the level of interest, both can happen simultaneously. But it starts from being able to prioritize, accept recommendation, not just in lip service, but really truly accept them, and then begin to do an implementation. If you were, like I mentioned to you before, in the 5-year plan, you know, that we talk about, if you have a 1-year, what I call, you know, planning and market, just to say, and you get buy-in, and you spend the next 2 years actually implementing, you know, 2 years later, people will begin to see the result. And once you can get a commitment to do that first one, they say build it and they shall come. Once you can get a local government that you can work with, that take this seriously and do this, once people can, it becomes like a tourist destination, more or less. People can just, oh, go to this area and go see what they did there. Once you can do that, the rest is easy. And, you know, other people will follow. But just believing that this is possible is our single biggest obstacle. People have lost faith in government. People have lost faith that anything going to be done worthwhile. So we need to recapture that faith. We need to recapture that belief and even the personal commitment to take part in these processes.
Okay. What does it take, sir, to build a new town or city so that your existing cities are depopulated or relieved a bit? I recall some years back, the current Minister of Transportation, when he was the governor in River State, he wanted to have another Port Harcourt, another city depopulate Port Harcourt. But that plan never came to light. It fell through because of probably challenges. So what does it take to have new towns planned and avoiding the kind of mistakes that have already been made in urbanization?
I call it the three-legged stool. I mean, you have to have all these three parts. For me, like I just mentioned, believe it or not, it seems to be the easier, but it's also the most difficult, is the collective commitment and determination. If you can have this, anything is possible. So you have to have, and it has to be collective, the potential residents of the area, the government, everything. You have to have the commitment. So you have to have that commitment first and foremost, and it has to be solid. Secondly, you have to identify the location, an appropriate piece of land that is suitable, that's not going to be some kind of a dump or a swamp that if you're not careful, but oh, I'll give you that land, go do it, and all of a sudden it's a flop. So you have to have a sound, you know, economically feasible and developable piece of land. And last but not the least, you have to have investors, because these things takes a lot of money. We're talking billions of money to do such time. And it's going to take more than just the government or one contractor. It's going to take a collective effort of people who believe and who can see return on their investment. So you have to have all three, not two or three, not one out of three, but you have to have all three. And of course, within that is also leadership, because to put it all together, you have to have leaders who are committed. Like we mentioned, a governor is the ideal leader of this type of thing, because most things happen at state level, not federal level. So if you have a governor who is very, very committed to this, who is, and I mean truly committed, not just for his own self-gain, or not just to be able to take 20% off and say, bye, I don't care, who's really committed to make this really happen. So if you have a leader who's committed to this, and then you can assemble around him a team of people, planning professionals, citizens group, developers, contractors, everybody, and you can really show leadership, these things are feasible. But unfortunately, we don't have that many of those.
Okay, at this point, we've had a very long talk with you. But one more thing before we go. Here in Nigeria, for instance, we've hinted on something like that when we mentioned noise pollution. But when you enter an everyday street in Nigeria, you find worship centers, you find companies and industries and offices, you find residential buildings, mami or small markets, everything just inside one particular place. Is that what is obtainable in other places? And if not, what is this a problem? We, for us, see it as, some of us see it as a problem,
no,
some don't.
Do you think it's
a problem? And if it is, what way forward and what are the things you think are the effects of this, or what they do to harm or bring any form of something that is not good for the environment?
My brother, I'm going to disagree with you on just this one point, and maybe unless I'm misunderstanding you.
Okay.
The thing that separates Africa from the Western world is the diversity, and most Western world are so structured and sterilized.
Okay.
It's residential, it's residential. Mm. It's commercial, it's commercial. Mm. If it's this and that. And everything is so boring. Everything is so... In Africa, I love when I can walk out and walk off a block and go get suya. Or go get palm wine, or be able to go buy Gary without having to get dressed.
Okay.
So the diversity and yes, there are problems with it. Don't get me wrong, there are drawbacks because when you don't control development, it can create a lot of issues. For instance, if the people doing the selling, they don't have a structure, they take all of their product, it's all on the street, they're peeling cones and everything is thrown there. Everything is true. If it's not controlled properly, it could be problematic and it can create pollution and other problems as we've seen. But I love the diversity of our built environment. Again, going back to noise pollution, if it's overdone, it's bad. But I love going back to radio stores and hearing music and going there and go buy me 2-3 CDs to take back to the U.S. You know, so there are advantages in all of that as long as it's controlled to a point, as long as it's regulated. I think for me personally, the African culture, the camaraderie, the closeness in the U.S., you can't go to my house without calling them first. If they show up, knocking your door, you look at your door, you just go back to your room. Like, forget you, I'm not going to let you in. Nigeria, you know, you can just go down, hey, what's up, my brother? You know, sit outside and start to talk. So there is some good aspect to that. Of course, you know, there's also some drawback too. So I don't know if I misunderstood what you said, but that's kind of like how I see that. I see more as a diversity, not in terms of race or anything, diversity of, you know.
I think you're seeing it more from the social angle, and definitely there's nothing wrong with that. But the issues of worship centers, having worship with also forms of microphones and sound systems in the same street where the next street, the next building, there's an office, and down the building there's a residential area, and then there are different kinds of shops, and even some people feel gas. You know, gas stations, mini gas stations, still everything just put together. Would you still look at that as good diversity?
It could be problematic, and I have to agree with you. When you begin to have what I call pollutants, like if you are dispensing kerosene in a very dangerous manner that's not controlled, if you have a mechanic, for instance, and a formica, all of that noises could be, they could just come to a head that in a way that could be not healthy. I agree with you. So it has to be done to a balance. And I can tell you, because every time I come home, I mean, where I go mostly is, Okota, Ago Palace area, Surulere, Fairstack, Ebutemeta, and Isaleko. So what area? Probably of all that area, Isaleko is probably the most problematic for me. It's just way too much. Okota and Ago Palace area, maybe also a little bit getting too much. But even there, once you turn in, go back in one or two blocks, it's not as bad. Yes, the main palace here, it's almost unbearable. But the moment you turn two or three blocks to your house or your family's house, there's still some street, hawking. There's still some music, but the intensity is less.
Okay, in terms of looking at Newtown's development, I know we've gone past that, but let's go back a little bit. Looking at Newtown's development, and we're talking about proper planning. If you mentioned that over there, all these places are in different communities, residential areas, different community, churches, worship centers, different community. And don't you think it's of course it's a structure that is, though you said it is boring, but don't you think it is a better structure if we're going to have development? Because I remember sometimes back there was, there's this particular area, and then their residential area, their residential houses, and then beside the residential house, there was a filling station, a fuel station, and then beside the fuel station, shopping complex. It's just really scattered and very confusing. And there was a time that there was an explosion at the filling station, and it affected, the residential homes. If we're looking at it deeply, don't you think it's a major problem, and it should be reorganized for the safety and the development of any community?
Let me ask this, since I've not talked to officials in Lagos for quite a while. What you are describing, you may not know the answer, but you can look into it. From what you can, the best as you can say, are all these different functions actually permitted in the building codes, or are they violation? Because if they're a violation, it's fairly simple. They can aggressively go and say, you're in violation, you're out of here. If they are permitted currently, then you have to look at a revision to the codes. You have to then, people, the citizens have to say, look, our local government, it's not tenable for us. We need to do a citizen review of your ordinances for your zoning code and what's permitted. And we need to put an input and maybe restrict these different uses. So me not knowing what the situation is, and you may not know as well, but if you could tell me if you know now, or maybe look into it, because that's a good start to go get your zoning ordinance for a particular, say, Isola or some area, and see what that zoning ordinance is saying. Because every people, I'm sure, even Lagos have zoning ordinances. So this is not the building construction code. This is the land use zoning code. So let's start with that. Because if this were not permitted, then you can put pressure on the local government to enforce their own code by making these things go away. If they are permitted, then you can lobby for their change. But I will stress and I will suggest that the solution is to reach a compromise. That whatever it is, whether it's already in code or not in code, when this is done, even those people ought to be given a stay. Even the workers ought to have representation at the table to make their own case as to why they think they need to be there. So that in the end of the day, whatever solution is developed, acceptable to all the parties.
Okay, thank you so much. Thank you so much, sir, for all these beautiful points and very enlightening points. But I'm looking at my time, and I must apologize to you because we've stretched this a whole lot. But
No, no problem.
there was
No
quite a
problem.
lot to discuss, and this is a very sensitive issue in Nigeria, talking about development of our environment, talking about all the challenges that we face in our environment. And you've been able to bring to light all these things. Thank you so much. I must appreciate you. And
My
at this
pleasure. My
point,
pleasure.
we actually have to wrap it up. We
Thank
have
you
to wrap
so
it up at
much.
Great, great.
All right. Thank you so much, sir, for your time
It's
and your
been very
wonderful questions.
enjoyable, and I look forward to hopefully going online, and I hope it's clear enough. And like I said, this is always something that to me is not a one-off. I think hopefully maybe in 3 months again or something like that, we could revisit. And I promise the next time if I get maybe 2 weeks notice, actually we myself check more with my Nigerian. I have a lot of nephews mostly who are in the profession in Nigeria. Okay. I actually get their input to kind of keep me up to date. Okay. I mean, I've recently just completed my PhD, so I've been around Nigeria since for the last 5 years nonstop. The last 2 years in particular. Thank you. So I'm fairly current, but they are more current than I am.
Okay.
And I think I can update myself to even make it a better discourse next time around. Again, God bless my brother and sister.
Before you go, we'll
take care.
Talking about this, you're saying that yes. In the next 3 months, and then, you know, you said you didn't even have so much to say. I mean, you didn't have so much understanding about certain things, but, I mean, we've gone almost 2 hours. So I'm wondering if you have to prepare. We should just book a whole day.
By the way, when I said 3 months, you can call me next week and I'll be ready. But I'm just saying it in terms of I'm quite busy here. This is also our election time. And even though I'm lucky, I'm not in the ballot like you described. I have no position. I have a lot of friends who I'm helping, of course, all the way to the presidency. So anytime after November,
No problem.
I will be delighted to do this again.
Thank you so much. We appreciate you. Enjoy the rest of your day, sir.
Yeah, take care.
You too. Bye, sir.
Bye-bye.
Yeah. Okay, like I said, that was a very enlightening conversation with Dr. Akinyemi. But at this point, please, I need to catch my breath. I need to take water.
Exactly.
I need to relax. We have to
Why
wrap it up here.
I should be we.
No, please, I'm speaking for myself. Alright, it's been great doing this. We have to wrap it up here. But stick to Spirit of Nigeria Radio. More content, more beautiful content coming your way.
Spirit of Nigeria Radio, bringing Nigerians in diaspora up to speed.